Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. It's Monday morning and time to consult with CBS senior business analyst Jill Schlesinger. The stock market appears to be very happy about this talk of an impending deal with China. How real is this? Do we know?
Well, I think the deal is real. The question is it substantially different than what was going on before? And from what we are hearing is that both sides are kind of throwing their hands up and saying, we don't want these tariffs anymore. We just don't. It's not good for either nation's economy. And so what I think is going to come out of this could be that it's the ultimate timeout. Nobody is declared a winner. Both sides give up a little bit. Maybe we get some concessions, but it's really hard to see how what is being discussed, again, we don't have details yet, but what is being discussed and leaked does not look all that different than where we were prior to this whole thing starting.
Well, then what was this for?
That's a great question. I think that maybe the reality is that this was something that was started but not, let me think how I could put this. Started, but there was no clear way to figure out how to end it. And so one of the things is, these tariffs could be lifted. Maybe the Chinese would come to some agreement that we would be able to adjudicate disputes with a third party. Most of this is, I think, ends up being a lot of talk about, hey, we'll better protect intellectual property rights, or we'll buy a bunch of American products. But it just does not look like it's all that substantive. And so what that leads me to believe is that both sides got into this and are a little bit sorry they did and now need to back off and sort of say, how do we get out of this and save some face?
Or is it because it was starting to affect a key constituency of the Trump administration in some way?
Well, I mean, look, that certainly can that could be. I mean, look, if China lowers tariffs on farm and chemical and auto and other products, and they buy some more natural gas from Texas, and they start to remove some of their foreign ownership limitations and things like that, I guess that's a good thing. And it is clear that the business community kind of jumped all over the Trump administration towards the end of last year and said, this is enough. And this is starting to actually impact the economy. I think we got the news that was very interesting, which is last year, economic growth came in at 2.9% for the whole year. And I wonder if we didn't have these tariffs, whether that growth rate might have been a little bit higher. As we start the 2019 year, we are looking at growth coming in at closer to 2.3 to 2.5%. And I think there are a lot of people who are business folks, manufacturing industry, car industry, that have gone to the Trump administration and said, if you ratchet up this trade war, then we are looking at not growth of 2.5%. We're looking at sub 1%. And that's not very good for the year before the political campaign season begins.
Well, two things. I thought growth was supposed to be 4%. And also that these tariffs meant that we were going to be collecting millions, billions and billions of dollars, actually, for the U.S. Treasury. What happened to that?
Well, we did collect some billions of dollars, but then we had to give it back to the people and the industries that were impacted by it. Specifically, a lot of farmers got whatever money we took in from tariffs got redistributed to the farmers who were negatively impacted. So I bet it's a big fat zero, or a net of nothing. In terms of the growth, remember that you're right, that the administration had said with the tax cuts, we're going to see 4% growth. Then they dropped that back. They said, no, it's going to be 3%, but it's going to be long term. Now we know that last year we got under 3%, and it's unlikely that we'll ever get to 3% in the coming year. So the answer to that question is, what happened to it? It didn't go that way.
Okay, that brings up another question. So if growth is not going to be 4%, then how are we going to bring down that $1 trillion a year deficit that we are running?
I think the answer to that is that we are starting to get the messaging that no one cares about the deficit anymore. It seems to me that, go pull the clock back and we're talking about maybe the financial crisis. Remember that one of the big pushbacks on spending during the financial crisis and any stimulus was, oh, we cannot add to deficits, we can't add to the national debt burden. And all those people who were Tea Partiers and fought against that, they seem to have just lost their voices. What happened? They don't care anymore. And look, I mean, listen, we had Warren Buffett's letter that was released a little bit more than a week ago. Even he said that I used to be really freaked out about debt and deficit, but it doesn't seem to be having a big impact. So the problem with debt and deficit is that it doesn't have a big impact until it does.
On the tax cuts, then, I just did my taxes. My tax rate at least it went up slightly from last year, but that's funny because I made some more money, so I expected that. I don't know that it stimulated me to become more productive. I mean, have we figured out what the impact of that's going to be?
Well, I think that what we are, remember early in the tax season, people were freaking out and the IRS said, oh, the average refund check is down. Well, now we have one more week of data. And guess what? Refunds tracking exactly where they were a year ago. So now things have sort of settled down a little bit. The big problem that we are seeing is that those folks who did get tax cuts didn't realize they were getting tax cuts. That's why their withholding had changed and maybe their paychecks were a little bit bigger, but they didn't necessarily spend that much. So what created growth last year was that there was government spending, some companies spent, and yes, there was some consumer spending. The question is whether that happens this year or not, or now that we are 1 year out from the tax change, whether anyone really changes the behavior. And here is the real nut of this. When you give big tax cuts to people who have money already, they don't tend to spend that money freely in the economy. If you give more of the tax cut to the low to middle wage earners, they do spend that money. And so that was one of the big complaints of this tax bill, is that it didn't go enough to the people who would actually spend the money in the economy. And so that's where we are. I mean, the tax cuts, in we have 1 year down, six more years before it sunsets and goes back to where it was.
So actually, you weren't kidding. Lower income people with big credit card debts should keep spending money anyway, because that will help the economy.
Oh, gosh, I don't want to say that. But listen, if you did get a tax refund, you know what you got to do. Don't go on vacation. You take the refund and you say, let me pay off my credit card debt if I have any. Let me put some chunk down on my student loans. Let me make sure my emergency reserve fund is beefed up. And let me start putting money into my retirement account. It's a funny thing. Whenever I say to people, well, could you find $10 per pay period? They're like, oh, yeah, I could do that. But then if you ask them in a big survey, do you live paycheck to paycheck? They say, oh, yes, I live paycheck to paycheck and I can't afford to save at all. But I think that you really can. So even if it's just 10 bucks per pay period, put that money away. Get it working for you.
In other words, don't listen to a thing I said. Listen to what you said.
Well, you're a fine broadcaster. I'm a CFP.
Pulling rank yet again.
Wow, she just shut you down.
And she sure did. And she does every week. Seattle's Morning News. This is Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. So, how do hangovers work? And is there anything you can do to prevent them? Let's consult the doctor.
Agent Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, there's this little rhyme, which goes as follows. Beer before wine and you'll be fine, implying that the order in which you consume your alcoholic beverages could possibly prevent a hangover. Is there any science behind this?
This was actually recently studied by a group of scientists in the United Kingdom and in Germany. So two different universities collaborated to do this. And what they found was that saying isn't true. The order in which drinks are consumed doesn't affect a hangover. The study showed that if you drink too much alcohol the next day, you're going to still have a pretty rough hangover.
Well, that's very discouraging. So, I mean, do scientists know what it is that actually causes what we describe as a hangover?
You know, alcohol has really been a recreational drug of choice for thousands of years, and it's the most commonly used recreational drug in the world. And yet scientists who've studied this really haven't been able to understand what happens when you get drunk. We don't have a good understanding of that, nor do we have a good understanding of what a hangover actually is. So we've studied a lot about what the long-term effects of alcohol are in the body, both good and bad, and so we have a good understanding of that. But the basics is what happens when you're drunk and what happens when you get a hangover really isn't well understood. Having said that, there's been a lot more science conducted on this topic in the past decade, let's say. So there is an effort to understand it better.
So some of the legends surrounding hangovers, that it's all about dehydration. So all you have to do is drink a lot of water and you'll be fine.
That's not held up to scientific scrutiny. When people have looked at, for example, electrolyte levels in hungover people and control groups, they're basically the same. And it's also been noted that people who have lower electrolyte levels don't end up having worse hangovers. So although it's a good idea to always stay well hydrated, it's a myth that if you drink water, that it'll take the hangover away. Now, what's even more important to note is now if you look on the internet, you'll see that there's a lot of advertisements for IV centers where they treat a whole bunch of things, but one of the things they advertise for is treating you the day after a hangover. And you can come in and get an IV with a bunch of vitamins, and it's supposed to take your hangover away.
Yeah.
Or they actually have mobile units that will actually come out to your house or your workplace, whatever, and treat you as well. Now, the thing is, what people are finding is they get these concoctions of vitamins and they get a lot of extra fluid in the form of an IV. But in fact, people aren't really getting that greater relief from their hangover. So clearly, it's not just as simple as dehydration.
One of the other explanations for a hangover is that this is your immune system overreacting, causing inflammation. What about that?
This is probably the most likely cause of a hangover. You get a hyperstimulated immune response, and it's really a description of kind of the flurry of immune system activity that's occurring within your body after you consume alcohol. And so this is kind of the leading notion of what causes you to have a hangover. Various researchers have noticed that hangovers are often accompanied by elevated levels of certain inflammatory chemicals called cytokines, which are the messaging system for our body's immune response. The symptoms of a hangover, like headaches, chills, fatigue, nausea, stomach upset, these things can all be caused by increase in cytokine activity. So this is what kind of the leading thought is. And this may be why if you take some anti-inflammatory medications like, you know, Advil, ibuprofen, aspirin, things like that, when you're done drinking, may lessen the symptoms of a hangover the following morning. The problem is that alcohol is irritating to the stomach lining, and anti-inflammatory drugs are also irritating to the stomach lining. So you got to be careful if you're using them in that setting.
So your advice is, once again, to do things in moderation. And by the way, the hair of the dog thing, that also doesn't work, right? The idea that you should wake up and just throw some whiskey down your throat is probably not going to help either.
Yeah, there's no science behind this. So the notion that if you drink a beer or some other alcohol in the morning and that will relieve your hangover, that's just actually getting you back towards being drunk again. The origin of the term hair of the dog actually comes from the 1500s when medical practitioners of the day thought you could cure rabies by drinking a potion made with the hair of the dog that bit you. But it turns out that that worked about as well to cure rabies as having a drink in the morning works to cure a hangover. So, you know, look, the only scientifically proven cure is to just keep your alcohol consumption to a minimum, or, you know, even consider skipping it entirely, although most people, when they're going to drink, they're going to drink. But, you know, keep in mind that moderate drinking is considered one drink a day for women and two drinks a day for men. And as I always say, moderation is really the best way to make sure that you're not harming yourself. And if there's a health benefit, you're getting the benefit as well.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
It's really too bad that hair of the dog thing doesn't work, because that'd be a lot cheaper than a rabies shot.
Well, I mean, I just use leeches. If I ever had a hangover, I would. And just remember, to quote Homer Simpson, the only dangerous amount of alcohol is none.
Is none. Right. That's a
there, good, the counterpoint
good life philosophy.
Yeah, and now for counterpoint to Dr. Cohen.
Unfortunately, there are a lot of people who follow that philosophy over Dr. Cohen's philosophy.
Moderation is definitely the key.
Right. CBS News correspondent Stephen Portnoy is back from Hanoi. And clear something up for me, Stephen. The official word, at first anyway, for the reason the meeting didn't lead to an agreement was that the president was smart enough to know when to walk away, correct?
Right. The thinking being that no deal is better than a bad deal, that the North Koreans wanted much more in the way of sanctions relief than they were willing to give in terms of denuclearization, and therefore the president did exactly the right thing by walking away from the talks. What the administration officials that we've spoken with haven't fully articulated is why this meeting had to happen in the first place, and what really was accomplished by having it at all, spending all the money to go there, and what'd you come away with it with? Ultimately, what they're stressing is the fact that you know, future talks are not out of the realm of possibility. You've got warm words coming out of North Korea about the president and how the North Koreans, through their central news agency, talked about how this was a success. It may have been a success for Kim, that's for sure. I mean, elevated with the president of the United States on the world stage. He's now had two meetings with the president of the United States. They're even talking about the possibility of relieving the sanctions. These are all things that were not possible before. And 8 months passed between the Singapore summit and this one in Vietnam. Much more time for the North Koreans to continue developing nuclear weapons, and that's what the intelligence community says they've been doing.
Okay, but if the walk-off was the success, then in his CPAC speech, didn't he blame the Michael Cohen hearings for ruining the talks?
Well, sure, and in a tweet last night, he said the same thing, that the pressure that he, essentially saying that the pressure that he faced by having his former attorney up on Capitol Hill at the very moment that he's trying to work out some kind of a deal with Kim Jong-un, that the pressure or Cohen's appearance in some way contributed to him walking away from the talks. That was a pretty bold statement for the president to make. He made it on Twitter last night. We have not had a chance to follow up with any of his more senior aides as to suggest exactly what he meant. Maybe there'll be an opportunity for him today to expand on it, but what he did say over his two-plus-hour speech on Saturday at the Conservative Political Action Conference is the idea that a terrible thing was done to him by Democrats, holding that hearing at the very moment that he is in Vietnam trying to hammer out a deal. The president was clearly focused on what was going on here in Washington, D.C., while he was on the other side of the world talking about North Korea and its nuclear program.
Now, Otto Warmbier also came up briefly at the speech, and the president says he loves the family, he loves Otto. He still, however, did not blame, he blamed North Korea, but would not personally name Kim Jong-un as the reason that Otto Warmbier came back basically fatally injured, and seemed to imply that that's what you have to do when you're in a negotiation to maintain the relationship. What did you make of that comment?
Yeah, pretty extraordinary, with the president saying that he takes Kim Jong-un at his word. Now, yesterday, the National Security Advisor John Bolton said, well, that doesn't mean that he really believes that Kim Jong-un didn't have anything to do with it, but he believes that Kim Jong-un believes that, which is, again, the same sort of thing we've heard from the president's aides for the last several years now, when we're hearing from the president, whether it's the Saudis and Jamal Khashoggi or it's Vladimir Putin and Russian influence in the last election. The idea that the president is willing to take these dictators, despots, whatever you call them, at their word and really not challenge it. Take it at face value and move on. That is the president. That is what he's done. Is what he's doing. What's interesting in this circumstance is you had the family of Otto Warmbier coming out and saying they will no longer be silent on this point. And they have been close to the president. They were in the First Lady's box at the State of the Union. They have been here at the White House spending time with the president. And the president has had very warm words for them. They came out over the weekend with a statement saying that they could not be silent any longer on this, that they believe that Kim Jong-un and his regime personally and directly were involved in what happened with their son. And they couldn't possibly believe that an American who was held captive and marched in front of cameras pleading for his life would be mistreated in a Korean prison without Kim Jong-un knowing about it.
Stephen Portnoy, live from Washington. Stephen, thanks.
You bet.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. From time to time, we talk with ProPublica journalist Marshall Allen, who specializes in ferreting out healthcare waste as part of his overall grand scheme to actually lower the price of healthcare. And you got a little surprised the other day. You don't have a medical degree, as far as I know, correct?
I do not have a medical degree. That's correct.
Even though you report on healthcare all the time, but yet you apparently got yourself named one of America's top doctors. How did that happen?
Well, Dave, much to my surprise, I got a voicemail one day from a company that was congratulating me on receiving one of these top doctor awards. And I'm sure you and your listeners are familiar with these kind of awards. You know, you see them in like airline in-flight magazines, regional magazines will put out their best doctors issue or their top doctors issue. And there are a ton of these companies, marketing companies, that basically give a doctor a title of best doctor or top doctor or super doctor, and then they sell them the opportunity to promote these awards. So much to my surprise, I get a call from one of these companies, and somehow they've made a mistake, and they think that I'm a doctor, and so they offer me one of their awards. So I got this voicemail, and of course, I called back with some anticipation to just see what criteria they had used to determine which doctor is worthy of their awards and how I became worthy of their awards. And this is actually, it's silly, and it would be tempting to just dismiss it, but it's actually a pretty serious thing. I mean, patient safety problems are injuring and killing hundreds of thousands of Americans a year. I mean, hospital-acquired infections. We have the opioid crisis because doctors are doing a lot of overprescribing. So how do they determine who's a good doctor and who's not? And I've done a lot of reporting in the world of medicine here in the United States, and I know that they don't really have criteria to determine which doctors are better than others. So, of course, when they told me I'm a top doctor, I wanted to call and find out.
And did you find out? Who did you talk to?
Well, I talked to a woman named Anne, and the company that gave me my award is based on Long Island, New York, and their marketing company. And I called Anne, and I didn't, you know, tell her right away who I was, but I just wanted to kind of ask how they had decided to give me an award.
Uh-huh.
And she said that they take nominations from doctors, they do research to look at my accomplishments, and they
Wow.
said that obviously I must be a leading physician. I think what happened is they somehow got me on a list. Maybe I went to a medical conference and my name somehow got put in someone's database somewhere. And so I think they're just cold calling people, offering them awards. You know, she told me she knew I worked for ProPublica.
Yeah.
She didn't know that ProPublica is an investigative news organization, but somehow it had the name of my employer there. She said, oh, I see you work for ProPublica. And I said, I do. I said, actually, I'm a journalist. You know, I cover healthcare. I write a lot about doctors, but I'm not actually a doctor. Is that going to be a problem, or can you still give me the top doctor award? And she hesitated for a minute, kind of paused, and then she said, oh, no, that'll be fine.
Did you point out that you have never you've never cut a patient open in your life?
I pointed out that I was a journalist and not a doctor, not a physician. And then I said, would it be possible for me to still get the award? And she said, that would be fine. And so she did say, you know, there's a nominal fee for the recognition.
Of course.
And she said, I can give you a reduced rate. It's only $289.
Whoa.
And of course, they accept Visa, MasterCard, and American Express for my convenience. But that sounded, you know, I'm thinking I'm not going to pay for this out of my own pocket, you know, and then I'm thinking about my bosses here at ProPublica. You know, if I put a $289 expense on the expense report,
they'll do an investigation on you.
They might. Yeah. And so so I kind of hesitated. And then she says to me, she goes, well, hey, this plaque commemorates your achievements and it communicates the achievements to your patients. It's a great achievement. I would hate for you to miss it, so I can get it to you right now for $99.
Wow.
And so at that point, I whipped out the credit card and gave her the number.
So you did take the award.
I did take the award, yeah. They asked me, well, what specialty should we put on here? You know, because usually you have to put cardiologist or some other type of specialty that's medical related. And so I just said, well, maybe put investigations on mine. And so they called me top investigator on my award.
You should have said muckraker.
You know, that would have been a little more colorful now that you mention it. But I felt I was very on the spot. I had to think quickly. But yeah, muckraker would have been a lot more fun. I should have done that.
Well, good for you. And this actually makes you a much better interview get, because instead of just saying reporter for ProPublica, I can say nationally recognized top investigator. Marshall Allen.
For $99, it's worth every penny.
I hope this doesn't compromise you now that you're part of the medical brotherhood.
Well, I think people know that even though I am now among the recognized elites with this award, I'm still taking the approach of looking at all this stuff with our healthcare system from the patient's perspective. And in fact, that's really what gets me about this thing, is that it's absurd, obviously, and it's totally silly. But what they're doing is they're putting forth this facade of medicine and of healthcare in the United States. The real absurdity here is how much it's costing us every year. We pay almost twice what other people in developed countries pay per person for our healthcare here every year. And a lot of it is also dangerous and harmful. There's a lot of overtreatment. And they haven't developed any real metrics for how to evaluate the quality of care that we get. And what they have developed, they don't make public. And so the medical industry continues to take as much money of ours as they can every year without actually even proving that they're doing something that's of high quality. And so it's not a fair system that we have here. And I'll continue to keep digging on it.
Marshall Allen from ProPublica at ProPublica.org. Marshall, thanks.
Thanks, Dave.
It is time for your daily dose of kindness. This is a great one. It's actually been going viral over the weekend.
Tomorrow is book report day, said Mrs. Inky Dink. Is everybody ready?
That is Dr. Belinda George. She might be the new principal at Homer Drive Elementary in Beaumont, Texas, but she is quickly becoming the favorite because of what you're hearing. She reads a bedtime story to her students on Facebook Live every Tuesday night. She's even in her pajamas for story time, tries her best to give a shout out to students who join her.
Tonight's book is Ladybug Girl.
I thought I'll try once, and the reviews from the kids, they came the next day. I saw you in your pajamas, and so I started doing it. I started naming it Tucked in Tuesdays.
Tucked in Tuesdays. 12 News TV says for Dr. George, it's a way to connect with the students, sure. But 94% of them come from some economically disadvantaged homes. She doesn't know if they're getting read to at night. So she thinks, I'll do it. They're also earning reading points, too, which helps them advance in school.
Every Tuesday, she reads a book on Facebook to help us get our AR points up. I love it.
They call them AR points. Some of the videos have 2,000 views and counting. Some parents have discovered her videos now that she's getting media attention. So some are watching from as far away as Kentucky. She says she's going to keep doing it, maybe even add some guest readers.
That shift in her brain where they think she really cares and they start working hard for you.
And the results are showing. Last year's literacy test showed just 55% of her third, fourth, and fifth graders were reading at or above their grade level. She says since she's become principal and started these Tucked In Tuesdays, students have made great strides in their literacy.
It's time for the Sports Insider, brought to you by your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is from that Iditarod of sports, 710 ESPN Seattle. Danny O'Neill back, in fact, from the Iditarod. So did it meet your expectations?
It was really wild to see. It surprised me in a lot of ways. First of all, the athletes are absolutely magnificent. And
really?
By athletes, I mean the dogs.
Oh, the dogs.
And that's what they refer to them as, is athletes. And one of the mushers that I got a chance to watch and even learned a little bit about her, she's featured in a documentary on Netflix called Loser.
Uh-huh.
And Allie Zirkel, I believe she's finished second in the Iditarod at least three times and has been competing for more than a decade now. And she sees her dogs as teammates. She's one of her dogs is the leader, the lead dog. That's, she really has a relationship with them. I thought they'd be stockier. I knew they weren't huge. I knew they weren't big 80-pound dogs.
Yeah.
But I thought you'd have big square-chested.
Sure.
And they're really lean. They almost.
Really?
Yes. Very, very lean. And you would, I wouldn't call them scrawny, but they're on the scrawny side.
Hmm. Well, when you think about it, they're like runners, aren't they?
So, completely.
Yeah.
That it's not, most of it is getting, and you watch them, when they get the sled up to speed, like you're really, they're putting their whole body weight, sometimes jumping almost off the ground as they get it going. And then it's at a pretty brisk trot. They also wear little booties to protect the fur.
Do they?
And their paws. Yes, they have booties on as they go by. I also saw Senator Murkowski.
Yeah, Lisa Murkowski. Yeah.
She was riding in one of the, like, behind one, because I just watched the part we saw is the ceremonial start. So it's not even an actual part of the timed race. They actually start the timed race in a place called Willow. And as Senator Murkowski's sled came by us, it veered off to the left, and the musher had to correct it. And we thought she was going to hit a light pole. She did not. But it was just a moment. My buddy that was taking a picture was commenting.
Senator Murkowski very rarely veers to the left. I just want to point that out.
Occasionally it's happened, though. Yeah. She's increasingly independent.
Yes, that's true. Did the little booties have little Nike swooshes on them?
I saw no sponsorship there. And in fact, what you see mostly is kennels. The mushers are advertising kennels. And I didn't see as much. Now, maybe it's because they're so bundled up. I didn't see as much sponsorship as you necessarily would have expected. It was really cool.
Well, the thing is, I mean, with the Iditarod, most of it takes place in the remote Alaskan wilderness with no audience. So who would see the logos?
Completely. It's not a solo event because the other racers, the other mushers are on the course. But you'll hear them, like, at different points. They'll talk about they get to a checkpoint. There was a race a couple years ago where there's really brutal weather when they got to the Alaska coast. And Allie Zirkle was like, no, I'm not first. Where's Jeff? Jeff was ahead of me, and she hadn't passed him on the trail, and because he'd veered off course. And he was okay, but it is, man, it's a voyage.
So it's not, I mean, it's not marked by flags or markers or anything, or you just go off into the wilderness?
Yes, it's a chart. There's a trail that's there, it's not, there's not people lining the raceway as you go through.
They're not there clapping for you.
You're going to go through massive expanses where you're very much alone.
Yikes. That sounds way too scary for any reasonable human to want to do.
It's the most Alaskan thing possible.
Yeah.
In a place where carving out an existence is a feat. Like, you can't just be neutral and survive up there. You have to work to it. Of course, their primary sporting event is going to be a race in which you're by yourself against the wilderness, and just completing is enough of an accomplishment that, yeah, we celebrate the winners, but just getting done, just surviving, not giving in to Alaska is the real accomplishment.
Yeah. Let's talk about football, shall we?
Sure.
Malik McDowell
is
apparently not going to ever play.
Correct. And this has been something I think people around the team and people who cover the team had suspected it was going this way for more than a year and a half.
And just refresh people's memories, he had the ATV accident.
He was a second-round pick out of Michigan State. He came for the off-season rookie minicamp and some of the off-season training. And then in the month-plus that they have off before the actual start of training camp, he suffered a serious head injury in an ATV accident. It's an activity that's forbidden by the terms of his contract. Uh-huh. So that opened up the possibility, and we don't know how much of his $3 million contract was ultimately paid out, how much of it was recouped through any potential grievance that the team would have against him, because he was released yesterday, formally released.
Yeah, and there's no chance any other team would pick him up?
Another team would essentially have to clear him to play football. And the Seahawks, as far as I know, that they never got to the point where they felt he could capably, safely play football again.
Yeah, well, that's a downer. On a happier note, you're off to spring training.
I am. I'm going to go from Alaska with a 19-hour stopover, my mandatory 19-hour rest stop in Seattle. And, yeah, I'm off to spring training this morning.
Well, have a good time. We'll talk to you there.
Sounds good.
Seattle's Morning News, 8:35. I'm here. Angela Russell's here from King 5. Carolyn Osorio is here. And Howard Schultz, potential presidential candidate, joins us live. Good morning, and thank you.
Yo, good morning. How are you doing?
Pretty good. First, I want to ask you, you've alluded to in a number of your interviews the fact that you would drop out if the polling didn't show that you were catching on. And I also heard you say that you've been doing continuous polling. So what does the latest polling say that you've seen?
Well, the truth of the matter is I've been on a national book tour for the last 4 or 5 weeks and visiting a number of cities. And in each city that I've been into, the response I've gotten both to the book and to what I'm saying about the fact that the two-party system is broken and the need for common sense solutions to our problems. It's not about polling.
So we don't have a percentage of people who are willing to vote for you at this point?
No. And in fact, I haven't said I'm running for president.
Right. All right. Let me ask you about what that would look like, though. Over the weekend, Donald Trump held this audience of conservatives spellbound for 2 hours. in a partially prepared but apparently mostly improvised speech where he, you know, he took no prisoners. He even had to be censored because he used a word that you're not supposed to use on the radio. Can you see yourself succeeding going up against something like that were you to decide to run?
Well, I've said from the beginning, this is not about Donald Trump. This is about the American people. And I think we're living at a time right now, which is a very fragile time, where so many Americans are being left behind. Millions of Americans have lost faith and confidence in the promise of the country. And the reason that I'm speaking out is that I believe that we can do better. I believe that the American people deserve a better class of politicians that are not fighting with each other, but fighting on behalf of the American people. And I know in my heart that this is a time in America where most Americans realize that there's something wrong and it needs to be fixed. Donald Trump, in my view, is a symptom of a much bigger problem. But he, in fact, is a problem. And the problem that he represents is a lack of dignity, a lack of civility, and the American people recognize that.
But
and
you
what
would,
I'm talking about...
But you would ahead, potentially sorry. But you would potentially have... You could potentially have to debate him. And if so, then you would have to be able to manage those exchanges.
So what's the question?
I guess the question goes back to Dave's question. Are you prepared to be able to manage that kind of situation when he was able to hold an audience for 2 hours and he had to be censored? That was I was just trying to follow up to Dave's question.
Yeah, I'm the fact that he's able to hold a audience for 2 hours of people that represents his base, I don't think that's the issue. The issue is that over 40% of the American people affiliate themselves as of right now, either as a registered independent, or 12% of the people view themselves as an independent because they recognize that the two-party system is not working. They also recognize that Donald Trump, despite the strong base that he has, and I recognize that, lacks a level of dignity and respect and the moral character to be the president of the United States in 2020. And that's what I've been speaking about. The fact that we can do better, we can solve our problems of immigration, we can fix our education and our healthcare system, and we can do the kind of things that once again recognize for the American people that the American dream is alive and well. This is not about going up against Donald Trump. It's about lifting up the American people.
Fair enough. Mr. Schultz, I just wanted to follow up on a town hall you did recently. And you said in that in during one of your comments that you don't see color. And I just wanted to say I was personally hurt by the comment. There was actually someone in a movie who said it perfectly. She said, when you don't see color, you don't see me. And it was hurtful because your company has such a great reputation around social justice issues. And even after the handling of the Starbucks incident, having the bias training, which was unprecedented to shut down a company. So do you understand why that was hurtful for so many people since those comments were made?
I certainly do. And I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, in that town hall, what I was trying to describe, and I don't think it came out the way I wish it could have, is that as a young child growing up in public housing, my parents were the kind of people that raised me not to see, not to be bigoted, not to be prejudiced. And what I was trying to describe, and unfortunately the words did not come out properly, is as a young boy, I was taught not to see color. Of course, as an adult, I see color, and my track record as the CEO of Starbucks and what we've been able to do, I think, demonstrates the number of things that we've done to demonstrate the fact that I feel so overly concerned and have been for many years about social injustice and certainly any injustice that relates to race or bigotry. And so I'm glad you brought that up because it's not certainly how I feel as an adult, but how I felt as a young boy.
Mr. Schultz, this is Carolyn Osorio. Speaking from the ground up as your third biography, why did you decide now to get personal for the first time about, you know, what some might say is a pretty rough childhood?
Well, I think at the age of 65 and knowing I was going to leave Starbucks for the last year and a half, I began to write this book, and I thought it was time to really reveal a number of issues that I had as a child that most people were not aware of. And I thought maybe it would also give other people a sense of courage to also talk about things that perhaps are difficult. And certainly as a child, I experienced shame and vulnerability and insecurity of being a very poor kid living on the other side of the tracks in public housing. And I wanted to write about that and reveal some things that I thought were important about what shaped me. And certainly a lot of that has to do with how I built Starbucks in terms of free college tuition, ownership, and healthcare, all things that I wanted to do to try and build the kind of company my father, who was a blue-collar laborer, never got a chance to work for.
And speaking of some of the policies you've implemented at Starbucks, including the college tuition, including the healthcare, even for part-time employees, at least two presidents now have tried to do something about healthcare and largely failed. What can you do differently?
Well, one thing I'd say is that it's interesting to me that of all the people running for president on the Democratic side, I think you would agree that I'm the only person that has actually done this. I have created a healthcare system for all of our employees. I have created ownership for all of our employees and created college tuition for all of our employees. So I have a track record of solving these complex problems. But if I run for president and I'm fortunate enough to win, I think the Affordable Care Act that President Obama put through should stay. We need to fix it because premiums have gone up. We need to go negotiate with insurance companies and prescription drug companies to provide transparency and lower prices. But the reason that we can't solve this problem is not because of how complex it is. The reason is the extremes on both sides of the aisle, the Democrat and Republicans, are unwilling to come together to collaborate and work together on behalf of the American people. And this is the same problem we currently have with immigration, the same problem we have with the national debt, which is now $22 trillion. And that's why I'm suggesting that if I run for president, I will run as a centrist independent to try and bring the two parties together and do something for the American people that unfortunately has gone on for way too long, and that is a government that is not working for the people, that is dysfunctional, that is polarized, and in many ways, corrupt.
But the polarization is not going to go away just because a centrist is elected president. So do you have the juice, do you have the elbow-twisting ability to, I mean, look what Lyndon Johnson did to get civil rights passed. He had to twist elbows. He had to threaten people. Do you have the necessary ruthlessness to do what you say you're going to do?
Laid back. Look, I don't think anyone has ever accused me of being laid back, but I'll take that. Listen.
Well, I think if you look at your ground up biography, you talk about it was so conflicted in childhood, and that's something you've had to work on as an adult to be able to, deal with conflict as the Starbucks CEO. And so, how are you going to, right now there's nothing but conflict going on in Washington. How are you going to use that experience to bring something new?
Okay. Well, I hope that you would all agree, despite the fact that Dave just called me laid back, that my track record at Starbucks demonstrates an ability to really lead a global organization and to do things that have never been done before in corporate America. That ability to navigate through some very difficult issues, I think, demonstrates my understanding of how to bring people together on behalf of the American people. This is not an easy task, but let me ask you this. How do you think things are working right now? You think they're working pretty well for the American people?
No.
With a government that is so dysfunctional and polarized and can't get anything done? I don't think the American people are too satisfied. And they know it can be fixed, but it can't be fixed under the current system.
Okay. I would just point out that as the head of Starbucks, you made a success serving delicious coffee. As president, you're going to have to serve castor oil lattes to a lot of people.
Well, I think the one common thread is that I built the kind of company that I was passionate and that I loved on behalf of the people who worked for Starbucks, which is now almost 400,000 employees. And the reason that I'm having this kind of conversation and contemplating running for president is my love of the country, wanted to pay it forward. I've been blessed to be part of the American dream, and I want to do everything I can to make that dream possible for future Americans, American families, who I feel don't have the accessibility that I have because things are not going so well for them, primarily because of a dysfunctional government. I want to fix that.
And when the national pundits bring up the fact that there are many people in Seattle who still will never forgive for the Sonics, what's the answer going to be?
The answer is that I've tried to really apologize for what took place during that period of time. I learned a great lesson about what it means to have that kind of power and responsibility, and should have showed restraint. There were a lot of pressures at the time. I can't bring the Sonics back, but I've apologized for that, and I realize that many Sonic fans then and today hold me accountable for that, and I am accountable. I understand that.
You know, last week, Governor Inslee came out and officially announced he's running for president, and he's running on the platform of climate change. He's going to be the climate change candidate for president. What is your reaction to his candidacy, and specifically, how would you address this issue that many Americans say is a top priority?
I think Governor Inslee has done a nice job as governor of the state of Washington. I think it's interesting that the one issue that he's talking about, which is central to our future, the state of Washington under his leadership did not pass the carbon tax that he tried to put through twice. I think that's an interesting issue for him to deal with, but I wish him well. And I think the issue that he's raising is important. I think there are many ways to solve this problem. The first thing is we have to recognize that science is real, and the Republicans that are rejecting this are wrong. And we need to have an honest conversation about what it is we're going to need to do. And I think Governor Inslee is correct in saying that time is an enemy. Whether or not he's going to be successful in gaining the nomination on the Democratic side remains to be seen.
So you're taking a stand on something like a carbon tax or the Green New Deal?
Well, what I've talked about in terms of the Green New Deal is I think the intentions of the people, they're well-intentioned. I think they mean well. But it's unrealistic when you read through the Green New Deal. As an example, they want to make every building in America have clean energy by 2030. It's not really possible. It would mean over 2,000 buildings a day would have to be transformed. Who's going to pay for that? The government doesn't own those buildings. And then free Medicare for all is a $30 trillion number. I think there are better solutions. But again, they're well-intentioned people. I just don't think they're realistic in terms of how you're going to pay for these things. And I think this goes back to the problem. The problem is that in many of these situations, these are false promises, false campaign promises. It's a good headline, it's a good press release, but it's not realistic. And I think we need to have a serious conversation with the American people about long-term planning and what we need to do about a lot of these issues and bring both parties together. And that is what I've been talking about for the last 2 weeks and resonating so well wherever I go, because people are frustrated and deeply concerned. And I think that the main concern with American families today, when you do polling, and this is a national poll, is most Americans now feel that their children are not going to have a better life than they do. And this is perhaps the first time in generations where people feel that. And I think it's unacceptable, and we need to do something about that to ensure the fact that the children, that our children and grandchildren have a better life than we do.
Thanks for coming on this morning. And just before we wrap up here, what's your timeline like? I mean, at some point you have to make this decision. So are you looking at deciding in a month, in 6 months, beginning of next year? What's the timeline?
I've said publicly that over the next 3 or 4 months, I will come to a firm decision. I'm enjoying traveling the country and speaking about the book. And this coming week, I'll be in Texas all week. Following week, I'll be in Florida. I'm learning a great deal from the American people and gaining insight and perspective. And I'll make a decision in the next 3 or 4 months.
potential presidential candidate and not at all laid back. Do I have that right? Howard Schultz.
Thank you very much. Thanks for the opportunity. I enjoyed it. Maybe we'll come back and talk some more.